We'll go on to case number 2. Do you want to see if there's something ticking in that bag? No, that was a joke. Okay.
Do you recall last time it was behind me?
Yeah. No. Listen. All right. Fourteen thirty-one, 82 Boyer versus BNSF Railway Company. Mr. Stombaugh, come on up. If the front row feels better moving, go ahead.
Time's up.
No. Oh,
that's a first for you.
Some things are irresistible.
I'm feeling comfortable already.
No. That's terrible. A person after my own habits.
May it please the court. My name is Christopher Stombaugh. I am appellate counsel for the plaintiff's appellants on this appeal. And this is not deja vu all over again, and I can tell you why. It is because 88.87 of the Wisconsin legislature clearly recognized that they wanted to limit the remedies for improperly constructed or structurally unsound railroad grades and trusses. The legislature specifically uses the language in 88.871 to say that it is necessary to control and regulate construction and drainage so as to prevent unreasonable damage, quote, due to highway or railroad grade construction. Okay. So it's not the failure to maintain the area around the structure. That, of course, is an ongoing duty. So therefore, as the court has said, in Wisconsin, the purpose of the statute is to prevent repeated lawsuits because of the failure to construct or maintain the trestle bridge itself. Okay, which is covered by the statute. That is why it is obvious in the statute when they say due to, they mean caused by. Okay, only property damage caused by faulty or improper construction and or maintenance of that property, okay, of the trestle falls under the statute. And if you go to 88.872 sub C, the court will note that to get the remedy, there must be a sworn statement of the alleged faulty construction. If, judges, we're in a situation where we don't have a claim of faulty construction, okay, what are these people to say relative to a claim?
Well, let me ask you this. If the intent of the statute is to prevent repeated damages actions, as you've argued, why is the failure to properly maintain any less susceptible to such actions than claims for failure to properly construct?
Because the issue is not for us is not maintenance of the trestle itself, the physical trestle. Okay, and this is really important to understand because if you look at our complaint, judges, what you see is our claim in the complaint is not about that this is caused by some failure of the truss. It's caused by debris coming into it. If we look at Record 21, our complaint, which the court, as I've heard from the previous argument, must recognize as being correct, factually correct, Burlington Northern, this is paragraph 1, the bridge trestle became blocked or obstructed, meaning that water could not flow under it because of debris. Okay. Paragraph 3, the trestle became blocked from upstream debris. Okay, resulting in blockage and preventing the flow of rainfall from freely flowing through the trestle, meaning underneath, just like any other bridge. And finally, this caused a catastrophic man-made preventable flooding and water invasions on plaintiff's property by failing to prevent debris and other obstructions, basically blocking the underside. So the issue is not maintenance of the trestle, the bridge. The bridge never failed. It was the maintenance of the area, the upstream area, which is not part of an improvement to property, which is specifically covered by the statute. So when you look at that, and then we go as well to section 88.871, and then you read 2C, which is, once again, you've got to say, what was the faulty part of this construction? There isn't one in this case. There isn't a fault in this bridge. The issue comes down to this, that it's clear that damage resulting from the construction and or maintenance of the thing constructed, which is either the railroad grade. And do we know what that means, ladies and gentlemen? The railroad grade is simply the slope of the track.
Look, why does it matter for purposes of the statute whether the negligent maintenance of the trestle created a one-time hazard versus a continuing nuisance? And how do you know this was a one-time occurrence? With climate change, you know, there could be multiple similar rain events going forward.
Judge Rovner, great question. And the issue, but that is really not the issue before us for this reason.
Oh, but we think it is. Okay. You don't think it
sure.
is.
Sure. Here's the thing.
I think we think it is.
Well, you may for now, but looking at this statute, as they look at each part of it, if you go to the other section, it all has to be caused by the faulty maintenance of this trestle or the railroad grade. If, ma'am, if it's outside uh-huh. of this, if it's caused by, if the flooding is caused by something coming in from the outside that is not part of a failure of the trestle and is not part of a failure of the grade, meaning every other case that this court is considering relative to this line, what happened is, sorry, it's getting a little dry here.
That's okay.
Every other case, be it Colbeck or Pruin, in every time there's a failure of the device. There's a failure of the road, or there's a failure of the shoulder, meaning the thing that is created that changed the normal drainage. In this case, there is not a failure of the trestle, and there's not a failure to maintain the trestle physical, the physical part of that bridge. The failure is negligence on in allowing debris to form upstream so that it came into and under the trestle and blocked the trestle. The trestle didn't fail BNSF. BNSF failed the trestle. The trestle didn't break. There's no part of it that hung down that created this. It's merely the same as if they had parked equipment just upstream. And suppose that they had parked equipment in the line and just left it there. Water comes through and forces that equipment underneath and causes a blockage. Is that a failure of the trestle? No. It's a failure of BNSF. Okay. And it's also not a failure of the grade because the grade is merely the slope of the track.
So look, let's go on to claimant preclusion.
Sure.
With respect to claimant preclusion, why wouldn't the spouses of the Irish plaintiffs be in privity with the current plaintiffs if they occupied the same households?
Sure. I didn't know if this was part of my rebuttal because that's their claim, but I'm happy to move to that if you want to right now. But the reason why is that this is a property damage type of claim. And under Wisconsin law, the husband and wife may have community property, but if you get your property or you inherit it, they have no right in your property. Okay, they have no individual right, or in your personal deed, meaning anything that you happen to own personally. Also, most of the people, I think, who are involved here were actually not even Wisconsin residents. So what needs to happen relative to the spouses is at least some inquiry, some factual inquiry, not necessarily to be decided by a jury, but some factual inquiry. Okay. Now, when we were, that isn't just the introductory part of the statute, Judge, that deals with what the causation aspect is. You keep going, and it's replete with it. It has to be caused. The harm has to be caused by a failure of the the improvement to property itself or the grade. And what we see here, even when we get into section right here, into section 2A, it says whenever that any county or railroad, I'm going to read just the railroad part, but whenever the railroad company has heretofore constructed and now maintains does afterwards any highway or railroad grade across a marsh, water course, natural or otherwise, it shall not impede the general flow of surface water so as to cause either an unnecessary accumulation of waters or water soaking to the end of maintaining the natural thing. Well, here's the problem. In this case, it wasn't the failure of the trestle. It wasn't the maintenance of the trestle itself. It was a failure to do things that were upstream, which allowed it to get blocked. It's just like in your bathroom. You can have a perfectly operating tub, but if somebody doesn't, allows hair to accumulate, you will have a blockage. That doesn't mean it's broken, and it doesn't.
Not
mean,
in my case, but go ahead.
Well, sure. I have a full head of hair, still.
And I share my position with your point.
Right, but look at the statute. Every time the statute is dealing with this, it is doing this in three separate places. It's saying it has to be caused by the construction or the maintenance of the thing.
Well, let me ask you about this. The Wisconsin Appellate Court in Prum said that the statute applied to claims regarding highway construction and repair. So right. Would we have to say that Prum is wrong for you to succeed in this case?
Absolutely not. Prum is right on for that point.
Then why do you want us to certify?
Because
doing certifying?
Well, because it could be your preference. Because the Wisconsin Supreme Court has not spoken to this. And you are not bound, under the Erie Doctrine, to a Court of Appeals decision, which is quite distinguishable. Because remember in Pruem what happened. In Pruem, there was an actual failure of the highway and a failure of the shoulder. It is exactly, it's in the sweet spot of this statute. And that failure caused it. In fact, that was the allegation. That was the failure of these, of the construction and the improvements to land caused the problem. But this is just like saying this. Clearly, the bridge is there, okay? But the fact that the bridge is there doesn't mean that it's a cause. Any more than if somebody took a car and ran into a bridge because they weren't paying attention to what happened. It doesn't mean the bridge caused the collision because they were inattentive. In the same way, BNSF was completely inattentive to their watershed, essentially, that was up north.
Mr. Stumbaugh, you're running into your rebuttal, but
okay.
What connection did Arkansas have to this litigation?
Arkansas, well, first of all, this is not the same litigation as the previous one.
No. What connection did Arkansas have to this litigation?
The connection that Arkansas had to this litigation, Your Honor, is that it was an appropriate venue for new claims involving BNSF because they did substantial business there. Arkansas law is favorable on a procedural basis.
Wasn't that really forum shopping, judge shopping?
Well, if it was merely forum shopping, we would have made exactly the same claims, and we didn't. Our claims now have to do with maintenance, and even though it talks about maintenance of the trestle, it's very clear from our allegations it has to do with maintenance of what led into the trestle and blocked it. That's
okay.
The claim. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Thornton.
Yes, Your Honor.
Hi.
Oh, you're just calling my name.
I'm calling your name.
Thought you were asking me a question.
Do you have anything to say?
The other way.
What I have to say is I think this court has already decided this case. The exact same argument.
We never make our minds up until we leave, unless you're talking about the last case.
I'm talking about the last case.
The last case.
I'm talking about the last case. This court examined the question of maintenance in some detail. As a matter of fact, the first sentence that you wrote, Judge Rovner, was, this is a lawsuit in search of a viable theory of recovery.
I know. It was a bit unkind, but okay.
In the Irish case, they tried a number of machinations, a number of efforts to save the case from dismissal. It was finally dismissed by Judge Crabb. And they admit on page 9 of their brief that one of the grounds of Judge Crabb's dismissal was faulty maintenance. Judge Crabb then asked them to address the employees, and they asked for an opportunity to amend and to amend again. Then they went down to Arkansas, and as the court pointed out, Arkansas had nothing to do with this case. They talked about looking for a fresh pair of judicial eyes. They talked about that this court had made an error, and that in Arkansas that error might be made again. We then transferred the case, or first we moved the case to federal court, then we transferred the case back to Wisconsin, and they appealed twice to the Eighth Circuit.
Can you tell me what your fees and expenses were for the detour through Arkansas and the Eighth Circuit? Do you know what your fees and expenses are?
Not off the top of my head, Your Honor, but I know that we've spent a substantial amount of money on this case for essentially the same reasons that we spent it the first time. And, for example, the affidavit that we had to do in response to Judge Crabb's request to verify that every one of these 60-some persons was not a Delaware or Texas resident, that itself was significant. We're talking easily in the vicinity of $100,000 that's been spent on this case so far, and it's a case that this court resolved, Judge Crabb resolved, and doesn't need to be brought up again. This court rejected out of hand the argument that somehow or another that this case was limited to construction. But then it said that the court had not fully developed that matter. Or that matter had not been fully developed below. Judge Crabb took a look at the statute, and a plain reading of the statute found that maintenance was expressly covered, that this was the exclusive remedy, and the common law claims preempted everything else, and also that damages were not available. That's exactly what's sought in this case, is damages. The sojourn to Arkansas was an admitted effort to look for a fresh pair of judicial eyes, or look for somebody who might be willing to overturn what this court ruled. That is a direct defiance of stare decisis. And there is no reason to certify this case to the Supreme Court. The court has found in Purim that this statute was unambiguous, and in the unambiguous provisions of this statute precluded any relief except for equitable relief or inverse condemnation. The statute expressly says it excludes money damages, and the statute expressly includes maintenance. The reading that plaintiffs give to the suggestion that the three or four references in the statute to maintenance somehow relate to ownership of the property and not repair or of the property is ridiculous on its face, and it really calls out for this court to level sanctions. The argument was dealt with at some length, Judge Rovner, in your opinion before, and you ultimately said it was not necessary to go there because it hadn't been fully developed below. Well, it was fully developed below, and Judge Crabb looked at it and looked at the unambiguous language, according to Purim case, of the statute and found that that was the exclusive remedy. The Kohlberg case, the Venn case, and the Hillowig case all are on point. It's also important to remember that they have completely failed to follow the statute. The statute requires a 3-year statute of limitations, 90 days filing thereafter, and a notice that lays out exactly what was wrong with their property and with legal description. They've completely ignored the provisions of the statute, whereas the Venn versus Manitowoc Rapids case says the provisions of the statute are mandatory and must be followed, and if they're not followed, that the case can't go forward. Now, in paragraph 25 and 27 of their amended complaint, they mention section 8887 at least three times, yet they ignore the statutory mandatory procedures that the Van Court case says have to be followed for 8887 to be brought to bear.
They obviously didn't comply with the notice requirement.
I'm sorry?
They did not comply with the notice requirement of 8887.
They didn't comply with the notice requirement. They didn't comply with the statutory limitations period. And the case of Kohlbeck versus Reliance Construction Company says that that remedy is the exclusive remedy for flooding caused by rail grades or highway departments as it relates to landowner claims. In terms of claim preclusion or res judicata, the issues are, is there an identity of parties? Is there an identity of causes of action? And was there a final judgment? Well, there can't be any question about that there was a final judgment. There can't be any question about that there is an identity of cause of action. The only distinction is, the only possible difference is there isn't an identity of parties. The court can contrast the Pasco decision decided by the Wisconsin Supreme Court with the Chicago Police decision, where in one case they were willing to say individuals advocating individual claims do have a privity of interest, whereas a union that has a wider concerns, as is in the Pasco case, doesn't have those same issues. As to the lawyer being the same, the transaction that gives rise to this case being the same, the panel deciding this case being the same, despite counsel's best efforts, the judge, lower court judge deciding this case is the same. It brings to mind the Bethesda Lutheran Home case, where Judge Posner of this court said that it was an error to not assess sanctions below because adding new plaintiffs doesn't unbar barred claims. Even if claim preclusion didn't apply, issue preclusion certainly applies. This is the judges look for finality and efficiency, and this is a direct contribution of finality and efficiency. The Jensen versus Milwaukee Mutual case is a case that found, it's their bus case exactly. It was a husband and wife who was in a car. The husband got in an accident with the Milwaukee Mutual's insurers. The husband brought an action. The wife supported that action. The court found that the spouse was bound by the disposition of the case against the husband. The DeGulli, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, DeGulli versus Camelli case, said the five factors to be considered for collateral estoppel, which Judge Posner also said he didn't quite understand, was whether an appeal could be taken, whether...
One is shocked that he doesn't understand something, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's what he wrote.
Yeah. He didn't really believe it, you know.
anyways, all of the DeGulli factors, except that whether the party can take an appeal of that order, are satisfied. And in the DeGulli case, they said that was sufficient to allow collateral estoppel issue preclusion to apply. It was the same case, the same laws. There was a full litigation by the same parties, represented by the same lawyer. And the Irish certainly had a motivation to seek the necessary relief. And Irish aggressively pursued it. This is a matter where Judge Crabb did err in failing to assess Rule 11 and rule or statutory 28 U.S.C. 1927 sanctions. This case defies the law. It is the classic example of a frivolous case that is repetitive of what this court already decided. The counsel has failed to take reasonable inquiry, both of the statutory provisions and the clear language of the statute that it only allows for damages and covers maintenance, and also fail, even though he cites the case at least three, excuse me, cites the statute at least three times in his complaint, he ignores the procedural provisions of the statute, fails to give any kind of notice, ignores the three-year statute of limitation, and fails to give the description of what was required. Significantly, three of the four Irish plaintiffs are still in this case. That matter was brought to the counsel's attention, and he nevertheless appealed on behalf of those parties to this case.
How many are dead?
Four are dead.
Four are dead.
Four are dead. One died before the flood. The three others died before the case. It's rudimentary law in Wisconsin. Dead people can't bring claims.
They're Can they in any other state?
No other state are they allowed to bring claims.
Because, boy, would we be inundated.
You didn't check that before you spoke. You just assumed it.
I've read a lot of cases. Let me submit. They certainly aren't in the 20 or so states that I read about are dead people allowed to bring claims.
It's very hard for them to do anyway.
It's very hard for them to do. And for their lawyer to consult with them, unless they're somehow involved in a seance or something like that, I don't know how they could possibly consult with these dead people. And reasonable investigation before bringing this claim, you just compare the caption of the Irish case with the Boyer case, and you see that three of the four are Irish plaintiffs, and four of the four are dead people. And how those can be brought is beyond comprehension. And even if the court were willing to give counsel a break on the matters of the other Boyer plaintiffs, as it relates to the Irish plaintiffs, as it relates to the Irish spouses, and as it relates to the dead people, they had plenty of notice. We gave them plenty of notice of that situation, and they continue. They list those people by name before this court and didn't drop those claims, despite Judge Crabb's unequivocal ruling that claim preclusion prevented the Irish plaintiffs from participating in this matter. This certainly has been a case that has been multiplied and unreasonably and vexatiously by counsel. And they make a big point about these are poor people living in the neighborhood, and BNSF is a rich corporation. But we're not seeking sanctions against the plaintiffs. We're seeking sanctions against counsel, because counsel is the one who's perpetrated this on the court and on BNSF. As rule or statute 1927 makes clear, when one party causes another party to incur additional costs, that party should bear those costs. And it's not subjective bad faith is not necessary. A pure heart and an empty head is no excuse for what happened. Even if the court, in deference, well, this time was Judge Easterbrook instead of Judge Posner, adopted the deferential standard of reviewing what the court below does, this court under Rule 38 has the power to grant sanctions itself when the appeal is frivolous and when you think it's an appropriate case for sanctions to be issued. To start this case in Arkansas State Court, resist the removal to federal court in Arkansas when it's clearly a diversity case, to resist the transfer to the Western District of Wisconsin, to go twice to the Eighth Circuit, to then resist what this court clearly expressed doubts about, but said it wasn't necessary to decide, and then when Judge Crabb engaged in a clear statutory interpretation of the plain language of the statute, and then to take this appeal, if this isn't the stuff that is a frivolous appeal that is appropriate for sanctions under Rule 38 by this court, then in 40-some years of practice, I don't know which case would be, but this certainly is.
Thank you.
Your Honors,
they have brought a motion for sanction in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals denied it after reviewing their motions.
That was the Eighth Circuit.
Yes, ma'am.
You are now in the Seventh.
I am. And this is a lawsuit that was filed by Arkansas counsel, signed by Arkansas counsel in the Eighth Circuit, in a state court. It is not inappropriate to bring a claim where there is appropriate venue, even if the defense doesn't like it. Okay.
So Arkansas counsel did this independent of you and didn't consult you, and you were surprised by this?
I was surprised because I was in trial in Wisconsin in a two-week trial when it got filed. Okay. I learned later, but here's what Judge Crabb did. Okay. What Judge Crabb did is she dismissed the plaintiffs. We did not resist the dismissal in this case. The review is for abuse of discretion. The defense had made the same type of motions. They made the same type.
And you didn't have anything to do with the objection to moving it to federal court in Arkansas?
I was named a counsel of record. I was on there. I did not file it. And more importantly.
But you allowed your name to be there as counsel.
Well. That is correct. I'm not ashamed of that. Okay, and neither I think should I be. Okay, Judge Crabb also denied these sanctions. This is, you know, Judge Crabb clearly is in the best position of having sat through the Irish case, as well as this. Wrote the defense did not show claim preclusion should apply to the vast majority of the plaintiffs, and could not go for the claim to be frivolous. This would have been, in a normal case, Your Honors, this would have been dealt with as a housekeeping matter. Okay, but from the very beginning, we were fighting, okay, the dismissal of this case and their claim for sanctions. Okay, and this Irish decision of this court left open for consideration the maintenance issues of the adjacent roadbed and the adequacy of inverse condemnation. But I want to ask you a question. He says we didn't file a notice. We didn't do this and didn't do that. Your Honors, I must stress, was this caused by the trestle or the grade? If it wasn't caused by the trestle or the grade, then we don't have a claim to file. The claim would have required us to say what the specific faulty construction was. There wasn't any, okay? Our claim is that it wasn't caused by this. So the idea of Pruim doesn't matter, because Pruim is because of causation by the faulty roadway and by the faulty shoulder. That's not the case here. And it's not our claim, and it's not what we allege in the complaint. What we allege in the complaint, Your Honors, is simply this. What we allege is that it was caused by the debris field coming in and blocking the trestle. That's not a failure.
Thank you very much. I will give you, Mr. Thornton, 10 days to get your costs that were associated with the Arkansas situation to the panel.
10 days for both that portion of it?
Yes.
When you say cost, you mean attorney's fees and
yes.
Costs?
Well, yes.
Associated with getting it back to Judge Graham?
Yes. And I'll give you 10 days to respond.
Thank you.
And the case will be taken under advisement.
May I ask a question just for
surely.
The court? And that is, there was a claim dealing with the diversity and those issues by Judge Crabb with respect to the Wisconsin case. That had nothing to do with Arkansas.
I have no...
I mean, I'm just... because that had to do with whether...
That's...
I understand what the court wants.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. You'll be able to respond to Mr. Thornton's submission. 10 days. Thank you very much. Case is taken under advisement.